questions. How can anyone mean well when they kill another human because of race, religion, sex, or any other man-made reason? Well, let me give start with something simpler. When I was little, in the garden where we lived, there would be a lot of snails that my parents, that were eating the plants and the flowers, and my parents didn't like the snails. So one day, when my parents were gone, I went in there, and I gathered up all the snails, as many as I could get, and put them in one place, and then stepped on them and scrunched all of them. And I thought I was doing something good. Yeah. In fact, I was creating a lot of negative karma and harming a lot of living beings and causing them immense suffering. Okay. So when people have ignorance, and if they believe in a wrong philosophy, yeah, a philosophy that says, you know, there is one right way and only one right way, and other people, you know, are harming us, or they're infidels, or they're doing the opposite of what God wants, and they've been educated in that kind of philosophy. And the philosophy also teaches compassion and kindness. So they believe the whole thing, but they don't sit and really think deeply about, you know, isn't there some contradiction here between, you know, being compassionate and killing that seems justified? You know, people don't think about that. So they just follow, you know, what they're taught. Okay? Or what about, and I say this and I don't mean any disrespect to the military, yeah, to individual soldiers, no disrespect at all. But, you know, if you grew up in a family and you were taught that, you know, other people were dangerous, they have a system of government that is different than ours, and if, you know, we have to protect our country from their system of government, and, you know, and that means that we have to go fight with them, and it's noble and glorious to defend your country. So you go and you go to fight, thinking, you know, it's brutal, but, you know, in your heart, in your mind, you're thinking, I'm doing something good. I'm defending my country. I'm preventing a wrong philosophy or a wrong system of government from taking over the country. And so you go to war, and then, you know, killing happens and more. That's what war is for, killing the enemy. But you think what you're doing is good. Okay? So that's how it happens. So it's really something to take the time and really question what our society is telling us, and question the philosophies that we believe in. Yeah. And like I said, most people don't, you know. You're there and you're socialized and you do what you're taught to do. So I think that's how it happens. So if the emptiness of the mind is nirvana, okay, first of all, it's not the emptiness of any old mind. It's the emptiness of a mind that has completely removed all the afflictive obscurations such that they can never return. Yeah, the emptiness of that mind is nirvana. So it's not just any old mind. But the question here is, what's going on with the conventional nature of the mind, the functioning aspect? Is that part of nirvana too? No, nirvana is something permanent, okay? The emptiness of that mind that has completely, you know, overcome all the afflictive obscurations. The mind itself, at that point, is something that is free of all the afflictive obscurations. Yeah, it's not free of the cognitive obscuration, but it's free of the afflictive ones. So that mind, you know, it's clarity and cognizance, and it keeps going. Okay, it's the mind of an arhat. So is that clear to people? Whoever asked the question. Okay, and the next one was, so in our comparison, we said the emptiness of the mind is both permanent and eternal. Okay, but the mind is momentary, a continuum of moments, each of which has its own emptiness that ceases when that moment ceases. So can you have the emptiness of the mind stream itself? Yes, of course. The emptiness of, let's just say, moment one of the mind. Yeah, when moment one ceases, that emptiness of it no longer exists. Then you have moment two of mind, which also has its emptiness. When moment two ceases, then that moment, the emptiness of moment two also goes out of existence. Okay. If you say the mind, okay, then the emptiness of the mind, if we just say the mind, we're referring to, you know, the mind stream. So, you know, the emptiness of the continuum or the emptiness of the mind. Since the mind doesn't cease in jet, because there we're talking about the mind in general, we're not talking about a particular moment of mind. Yeah. So that emptiness is going to be eternal because that mind is eternal. So it depends on how you phrase it. Are you talking about one moment of mind or are you talking about the mind in general? So you'll get different answers about whether they are eternal or not. Okay, is that making some sense? Okay, so somebody, how do you compare the two, direct perceiver's satantrika presentation and direct perceiver's prasangika presentation? So I think it looks what this person is doing is like there's two sets of what you're comparing. One set is comparing direct perceivers and direct reliable cognizers. Okay. And another set is comparing satantrika view and prasangika view. So first you've got to do the first comparison. Okay. So I'm giving whoever did this your homework back. Okay. Yeah. So first do a comparison. Looks like they tried to do it here, but they missed a important element. So I recommend when you go back and do it, you write out the definition of direct perceiver and direct reliable cognizer, and first do that for to first just focus on the Satantrika system, then compare them according to the Satantrikas. Then write out on another page the definitions of those two, and then compare them according to the definitions according to Prasangika, and then compare them according to Prasangika. Yeah. And then you can put your answers side by side and see if they match or not. Okay? Because otherwise you're combining two comparisons, and it's getting complicated. But look at the definitions carefully. Yeah, because the definitions, are not the same. Just compare those things within, those two things within one system is what you have to look at. Okay, so we just did four reliable cognizers according to the Prasangika system. So the direct reliable cognizers, the inferential reliable cognizers, the reliable cognizers based on an example, and the reliable cognizers based on authoritative testimony. So here those four are presented as four distinct kind of categories. Now, the number of reliable cognizers differs according to context. In the above classification, reliable cognizers based on authoritative testimony and based on an example are forms of inferential reliable cognizers. They are listed separately in this context due to their specific functions. In this case, these are important phrases, in this case, an inferential reliable cognizer is one based on factual inference, a specific type of inference. And so here the name inferential reliable cognizer is given to that specific instance. The second one, inferential reliable cognizer, Number three and number four of that list can actually be are part of number two. Okay, so in that context, when you say inferential valid cognizer, it's referring to that one that's factual inference, which, in this context is a broad. It's referring to that, an inferential reliable cognizer is one based on factual inference, a specific type of inference. So here the general name, inferential reliable cognizer, actually applies to that one. Okay. However, when we say the comprehended objects of reliable cognizers are of two types, evident phenomena and obscure phenomena, then reliable cognizers are also two. Okay, so before they were three, now they're, but the last two could be incorporated in the first one. Now they're two, and here they're divided according to their comprehended objects, evident phenomena and obscure phenomena. In this case, reliable cognizers based on authoritative testimony and the reliable cognizers based on an example are included in inferential reliable cognizers, with that term now being used to refer to all three of those inferential reliable cognizers. Okay. It is not uncommon that terms in a text have more than one meaning depending on their context. Yeah, remember that. Because that's the source of so much confusion that we get, okay? So we must take care not to get confused, which happens easily. Okay. So it's kind of like you're talking about apples, but there's, what are there? There's delicious apples, there's Roman apples.
Macintosh.
Green apples.
Granny Smith.
Yeah, so a lot of different kinds of apples. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, depending on what the context is, if you say, please can I have an apple, that could mean a lot of different things. Because if it's in the context of you're at an apple orchard of Washington State apples, they're a special brand too, aren't they? No?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're so delicious, but they grow all kinds of apples.
Okay, well, you're at the orchard of a particular kind of apple. If you say, may I have an apple, it's obviously going to refer to that specific one. It's not going to refer to the kind of apples that are grown somewhere else. Okay? So kind of like that. While reliable cognizers correctly ascertain their objects and give us reliable knowledge so we can accomplish our aims, other awarenesses, such as correct assumers, inattentive awarenesses, doubt, and here is referring specifically to deluded doubt, but the others too, and wrong awarenesses do not. These and other unreliable awarenesses cannot be trusted because we will not be able to achieve our purposes by relying upon them. If we have bad eyesight and mistaken orange for a grapefruit, that can happen even when you have good eyesight, depending on the oranges. Yeah, but if we have bad eyes, if we make that mistake, we will not purchase the fruit we want. Similarly, if we believe that the self is permanent or that phenomena exist as self-enclosed, independent entities, we will not be able to realize the emptiness of inherent existence or attain nirvana. Okay? So what we ascertain influences what we're going to be able to do. So if we're glued to the idea that there's a permanent soul, as much as we try to meditate on emptiness, we're not going to have the correct view of emptiness. And without the correct view of emptiness, we're not going to attain nirvana. Okay. Subsequent cognizers are minds that know what has already been known in that continuum. Okay, so it's talking about one continuum of knowers. It's not talking about yesterday looking at the orange and today looking at the orange. Yeah. So, the first moment of a visual consciousness knows red. Immediately subsequent moments of that visual consciousness also know red. So tantricas say subsequent cognizers are not prime cognizers because unlike prime cognizers that know the object by their own power, subsequent cognizers know the object by the force of the prime cognizer inducing them. Okay. But prasangikas say that subsequent cognizers are direct reliable cognizers. And in the case of inferential cognizers, this is because the second moment onward of an inferential cognizer remembers the object inferred directly. It doesn't rely on a reason or logical mark to know the object. Okay? For Sotantrikas, and here's the key, for Sotantrikas, direct, indirect perceiver means without a conceptual appearance. For prasangikas, it means not relying on a reason. Okay, so two different meanings of the word direct in different contexts. However, in another context, such as speaking about a direct realization of emptiness, prasangikas take direct to mean non-conceptual. Yeah, so go figure. I wonder if that's a hangover from they're so used to talking from a sotantrika view, if that's a hangover from it or not, I don't know. Our knowledge about an object may gradually evolve via these various cognizers. For example, a new science student hears about bacteria from his teacher and gains a rough idea of what they are. This is a correct assumption. His knowledge also involves inference by authoritative testimony because he trusts his science teacher's knowledge, even though he cannot yet verify the information for himself. He learns about the structure of bacteria by seeing a model or a diagram, okay, which is inference based on example. If he then looks under a microscope and sees some bacteria, those bacteria become evident phenomena that he knows with a direct reliable cognizer. So I guess microscopes include, they can still, what you see, be direct. And it sounds like then through telescopes that would be direct as well. Through executing various experiments and gaining reliable data, he will be able to have an inferential reliable cognizer of other properties of bacteria that are slightly obscure phenomena. Okay, so you can see in learning about one object, there's many different kinds of cognizers that may come into play. Yeah, so this is actually a good example. Okay, so medicine meal time tonight. Yeah, take an example of something that you are learning about and look at all the different types of cognizers that are involved in your learning about that thing. Just pick whatever it is, okay? Someone was telling me at lunch that what came up is people are very unsure nowadays of about authoritative testimony because they don't know who to believe. And people are also unsure about direct perceivers because the actual data could have, you know, the sense data, for example, in pictures or whatever, could have been altered. Okay. Thank you, technology. Okay. So, good points of technology, bad points of technology, you know? So, at some point, you know, there's criteria coming up for how to assess what are reliable, authoritative, authorities, okay? So we'll come to that. It's just, and so you have to be smart and look at things. But again, it doesn't, I think, although they present inference by reliable authority, it sounds like from that title that it should be incontrovertible, but I think that that inference by authoritative testimony could, you know, you could change your mind because the authoritative testimony changes. You know, direct perceivers, if they're reliable ones, that's for sure. Yeah, inference is going to be good too. That's not going to change. But the conditions of reliable testimony, if you start out with only certain, like in this example here, The student is learning about bacteria from their science teacher. So they trust their science teacher. They figure, you know, this guy's been hired, so he has a good education, and what he's telling them is accurate. Yeah. But it could happen, as we all know, that science changes its mind. Okay. And so what you learn about bacteria this year is not going to be valid information about bacteria in 10 years from now. Yeah. So you could have that kind of thing. Or you could have a science teacher that has read all the latest experiments up to June, but hasn't read all of the ones up to October, and there's some new ones in September and October that have some new data, but he doesn't teach you that because he hasn't read it. You know? So he's authoritative in what he's read, but he hasn't read the latest thing. Okay. So it's this kind of thing that, you know, we have to trust at some level. Yeah. If we don't trust anything, then, you know, we're really not going to be able to function. Okay? So we have to trust at some level, checking things, you know, having checked things out. And then if in the process of going along, we find out that, you know, there's new information that we didn't know, or the testimony changed, or whatever, then, you know, then we have to revise our idea. Okay? You know, like the examples always, you know, your mother is reliable testimony for, the date and time you were born. Okay? So your mother tells her you were born at, you know, 5 minutes past midnight on such and such a date, but actually she was thinking of Pacific time and you were born in Mountain time. So, you know, it isn't that exact time, and it may be, even a different date because, or like exactly at what time do you say the baby comes out? Yeah. Okay. So, you know, there's these kind of things that can happen. Yeah. But we have to do the best we can. Okay, however, talking about our science student again, he may be able to verify that his conclusion is an inferential reliable cognizer only later on. First, he needs to make sure that the research data are valid and can be duplicated by others. Even if his data are reliable, they may not be complete, thus skewing a conclusion based on them. New data about other properties of bacteria may cause him to rethink his initial conclusions. For this reason, many scientists consider the initial knowledge from their research to be a correct assumption or even doubt. Or even they consider it, you know, direct perceiver or inference, it may not actually be. Okay? So it's an interesting point here that sometimes we don't find out until later if our cognizer was a reliable one or not. In many areas of scientific research, human knowledge rests on assumptions. Even though scientists have supportive reasons for drawing certain conclusions, those conclusions are by no means hard and fast. They will be verified, denied, or revised later on as more data are collected. It may take a while for correct conclusions to be known by inference. Those of us who learn of new discoveries by listening to experts or reading scientific journals will have either a correct assumption or an inferential cognizer by authoritative testimony, depending on how well we understand the explanation. Or we may have a wrong consciousness if the explanation is wrong and we believe it, or even if it's right but we misunderstand it. Okay, so more questions for for medicine, meal, and breakfast. Okay, so consider why having reliable cognizers is important in your daily life and in your spiritual life. So this is an important question. You need to think about that one. Make examples of times when you have had an inattentive awareness or deluded doubt. How did they inhibit your full knowledge? Okay. 3, make examples of wrong awarenesses, such as seeing things incorrectly or misunderstanding the meaning of what someone said. Have you ever had a wrong awareness but not known it was incorrect until sometime later? Yep. And sometimes we have stood by our wrong awarenesses, refusing to consider any other information until we absolutely have to. And then 4, make an example of how your understanding of a topic began as a wrong consciousness or its doubt and slowly evolved to a correct assumption and then to an inferential cognizer, a direct perceiver. Okay, so make examples of these. Okay, so medicine, meal, breakfast, conversation. So then we have a chart, reliable cognizers and unreliable awarenesses according to Chandrakirti. Okay, so you can take a look at that. And then we'll go through what's coming, we'll describe it. Okay, so direct reliable cognizers. This is all Chandrakirti now. Reliable cognizers have specific characteristics, and not all our cognitions meet these standards. Learning the descriptions of the various types of reliable cognizers helps us to identify them in our own experience, and that lets us know whether to trust what we're seeing and thinking. Wrong awarenesses and correct assumptions are not reliable cognizers, even when we mistakenly think they are. Direct reliable cognizers are of 3 types: sense, mental, and yogic direct reliable cognizers. Okay, so just because we saw something or we believe something doesn't mean that that cognizer is a correct one, is a reliable one. I remember, you know, when they were talking so much about having cameras on the police, yeah, then somebody did a video showing an encounter of the police with somebody, okay, from the perspective of the camera that was on the cop's, you know, jacket. And you look at it and it's like going like this, and there's the sound and the thing, I mean, it's really disturbed. It's not peaceful and quiet. And you look at that and, you know, you say, boy, you know, there's some violence going on between the cop and the person. Then they showed that same situation that they filmed from the cop's camera from about 10 feet away, and it's 2 people doing jumping jacks. But from the perspective of the clip on camera, it looks like they're tussling and there's violence. From 10 feet away, they're doing jumping jacks. So that really made me stop and think. Yeah, so if you were going to have that kind of information as evidence in a court case, you would have to really make sure that, you know, that could be called into question quite easily. You know, it could very well be that the video taken from 10 feet away is much more reliable, yeah, than the one on the cop's camera. Okay, So, sense, direct, reliable cognizers know their objects, sight, sound, smells, tastes, and tangible objects, directly by depending on a physical cognitive faculty. So, the subtle matter in the eye, in the ear, the nose, the tongue, and so on. Okay. These reliable cognizers enable us to know our surroundings and the things within them. Okay, so that's good. I mean, if you're trying to walk somewhere, you need some reliable cognizers. If you know, oh, there's a tree, you know, oh, there's gravel on the path, oh, there's a hole in the path. Okay, so you need those kind of reliable cognizers. You also need to listen because, you know, there could be a car or a truck coming from behind you or, you know, okay? Then, mental direct reliable cognizers correctly know their objects by depending on a mental cognitive faculty, that is, on another consciousness that induces it. Mental direct reliable cognizers include clairvoyance and consciousnesses that know our own feelings of happiness and pain. So when we studied the different super knowledges, all of those are mental direct perceivers. Okay. Yeah, and also when we're experiencing our own pain or pleasure and we know those feelings, that's done by a mental reliable cognizer. They also include conceptual subsequent cognizers induced by inferential valid cognizers, such as the second moment onward of an inferential cognizer of impermanence, and memory consciousnesses, such as the consciousness remembering a person we met last week. So remember the subsequent moments of a conceptual mind of an inference or an accurate memory, you know, is considered a mental direct reliable cognizer, because here direct means it doesn't depend on a logical mark or reason. Okay. Then yogic direct reliable cognizers are mental consciousnesses that know their objects, the 16 attributes of the four truths, and subtle and gross selflessness, by depending on a union of serenity and insight. These direct perceivers are essential to overcome defilements. So they're in a whole other class, you know. We don't see emptiness with our eyeballs. Not the kind of emptiness that's going to lead us to liberation. Yeah, the emptiness in a dish or a bowl, that we see with our eyes, but not the emptiness. That is the ultimate truth. Yeah. So again, this is important because people hear all sorts of things and they hear the word emptiness and then they get some feeling of emptiness, or they look out and they don't see anything, yeah, like you're seeing right through a person or something like that. And then they think, oh, that's the ultimate truth. That's the emptiness of inherent existence. Yeah. So this is why it's quite important to study, because if we know things, then we can check our experiences and see if our experiences fit the definition of these different things, you know. Otherwise, we just make things up ourselves. Yeah, I know I did. Yeah, you hear some word, and then you have some experience, and you think, oh, that must be what they're talking about. Yeah, and it isn't anywhere near what they're talking about.
Like luminous.
Yeah.
I got tricked by that one for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Like we hear the mind is luminous. So then we think the mind is shining. And we're looking for luminous light, you know? So we're trying to find the conventional nature of the mind, and we're looking, okay, where's the light coming from? Yeah? Or we hear the term subtle consciousness. Yeah. And then we have some experience that's, you know, isn't as gross as we usually are, and we think, oh, that's the subtle mind. An evident phenomenon, such as the sound of leaves rustling in the breeze, is known by a sense-direct perceiver, in this case, an auditory consciousness. By means of mental direct perceivers, we know that we feel happy from hearing that sound, and we can remember the sound of rustling leaves the next day. A highly evolved consciousness, a yogic direct perceiver, realizes the subtle impermanence of both the sound of the leaves and the happy feeling, and of the leaves themselves. Okay, so here what we're getting at is you can have one object, but different aspects of that object are known by different cognizers. Yeah. So we usually think we know an object if we see it with our eyes, you know. Okay, there's the cup. I know the cup. Done, finished, that's it. But actually, you know, there's a whole lot of other stuff with the cup, you know. In this example, it's, well, what kind of feeling did that generate in me, seeing that cup? Yeah. What about the impermanent nature of the cup? That isn't visible to my eyes. I don't know that one. They say that it appears to our eye consciousness, but we don't perceive it. Okay. So not even, we don't even perceive everything that appears to, you know, to a thing. So, you know, what about the emptiness of the cup? We don't know that. But you see, we're very gross, and we think, okay, I saw a physical object, that's it. But actually, there's so much more to every kind of object. Even from a scientific view, I mean, imagine looking at this object and thinking of all the different kind of elements and the elemental chart that compose this object. If you did that, that would look really different to you. Or imagine what the atomic structure of those elements, or the molecular structure of, you know, when elements are combined to make the material that formed this. Okay, so there's so much there. That we aren't aware of. Then inferential reliable cognizers. To be able to benefit sentient beings most effectively, we must gain the direct non-conceptual cognizer of a Buddha, or cognizers of a Buddha, so that we will clearly perceive all phenomena, both ultimate truths and conventional truths. Unlike Buddhas, at present, we ordinary beings are not capable of directly knowing slightly obscure and very obscure phenomena. We can't know them directly, but must rely on an inferential cognizer, a mind that non-deceptively realizes an obscure object in dependence on a reason. Okay? So that's how we must initially know these objects. Afterwards, we can develop yogic direct perceivers of them. Inferential cognizers must trace back to direct experiences and share direct perceptions. Although our initial access to an object may be through reasoning, in time an inferential cognizer can lead to direct experience. Okay, let's say of impermanence or selflessness. We initially know emptiness through an inferential cognizer, but by continuously familiarizing our mind with it in meditation, that is a union of serenity and insight, we will be able to dissolve the conceptual appearance and realize emptiness with a yogic, direct, reliable cognizer. An inferential cognizer not only depends on direct experience, but also leads to it. We use inferential cognizers often in our daily lives and at our jobs. According to classical Indian logic, an inference is generated by means of a syllogism, a statement with four parts. So the four parts: a subject, a predicate, a reason, and often an example. To teach the parts of a syllogism, Buddhist monastics often use the syllogism: consider sound. It is impermanent because it is produced by causes, for example, like the last moment of a flame. The last moment of a flame, you know, we go, how does that show that things are produced by causes?
Or that sound.
It does. Well, no, you first, apparently the example usually, not always, has to be something that is more readily known. And so if you understand the example, then it's easier to understand the syllogism. What this means here, okay, how does the last moment of a flame have anything to do with sound being impermanent? Because the flame, the last moment of the flame, after that, there's no flame. That means that the flame existed due to causes. When those causes ran out, the flame stopped. So that's showing how the flame is produced by causes. Then, you know, if you understand that, then that helps you understand how sound is produced by causes. Now, this syllogism, okay, in ancient India was a big deal, yeah, because the people who followed the Vedas said that the sound of the Vedas was permanent. It existed in space, unchanging, and it was permanent. Now, we didn't grow up believing in the Vedas and in their permanence. And we grew up knowing that if you hit something, it makes a sound, and we can listen to it, and we can hear it change. Okay, but apparently doing this, you know, didn't convince the Brahmins that sound was impermanent. Okay, so for the Brahmins, they needed this syllogism. Okay, yeah. I mean, I remember hearing this and going, huh? You know, you listen to a bell and you know the sound is impermanent. Why, you know, so this is what I figured out about it, okay? Okay, so although this syllogism may not stir us, it was extremely important for Buddhists in ancient India. This is the argument they used to refute the assertion of Brahmins who believed that the sound of the Vedas was permanent and unchanging. Okay. In this syllogism, sound is the subject, we'll call it A, you know, about which something is to be proven. Is impermanent is the predicate, we'll call that B, which is the attribute we want to establish about sound. Because it is produced by causes is the reason, we'll call it C, we use to prove the thesis. The thesis is the subject plus the predicate. Okay. For example, like the last moment of a flame is the example. The thesis is what is to be proven, the combination of the subject and the predicate. In this case, sound is impermanent. So that's what you're trying to prove. Okay. Maybe we should do something that grabs you more. Okay. How about The relationship with the person I care about is impermanent because it's produced by causes. Does that one stir you a bit more? Do you think of somebody that you care about? Let's just do the person. We don't even have to talk about the relationship. Okay. Somebody I care about very deeply is impermanent because they're a product of causes. Like the last moment of a flame of lamb. Okay? So think of somebody that you care about. And when you think that they're impermanent and here we're even just, you know, we can talk gross impermanence, that they're going to die, does that produce something inside your mind? Yeah? Okay? So it's often better use something that's going to stir us in some way, okay? Then the syllogism becomes more alive. Okay, so to understand this, the person who hears the syllogism needs to understand three criteria of a correct inference. Okay, let's go back to the parts of the syllogism. Okay, so we'll say Joe. Okay, Joe is the person we're all deeply attached to, so it could be whoever you want to call it. Joe is impermanent because he's a product of causes. What's the subject?
Joe.
What's the predicate?
He's impermanent.
What's the reason?
Because he's a product of causes.
Okay.
Product.
Because he's a product. Yeah. And what's the thesis?
Joe is impermanent.
Okay. So you're wanting to prove Joe is impermanent. Maybe in your heart you don't want to know if Joe is permanent or impermanent. You want to go on being ignorant and thinking that Joe is permanent. What do you think? Yeah?
That is a syllogism too.
Huh?
You can run that as a syllogism too.
Oh, what?
Joe is
permanent.
Because I don't want him to die.
Yeah, exactly. Joe is permanent because I don't want him to die. We'll do that one afterwards, okay? Yeah. Well, we could do it right now. Okay. Well, first we have to do this part. We haven't learned the three criteria yet. To understand this, okay, so now, once you know the parts of the syllogism, there's three criteria of a correct inference. The first one is the reason applies to the subject, and that in basic philosophy corresponds to the major premise. So this is the relationship between the subject and the reason, specifically that the reason is a property of the subject. Okay, so being produced by causes is a quality of Joe. Okay, do you agree Joe was produced by causes? Yeah, he didn't appear out of nowhere without any cause. Then the second, so that's the first criteria, the relationship between the subject and the reason. Second criteria is called the pervasion or the entailment, and that corresponds to the minor premise. This is the relationship between the reason and the predicate. Okay, if something is the reason, it is necessarily the predicate. So if something is produced by causes, it is necessarily impermanent. Are you okay with that? If something's produced by causes, it's impermanent? Yeah, you know, the cup's produced by causes. You fall down, it falls down and breaks. And, you know, yeah, that's okay, right? Yeah, we can accept that one. Then the counter-privation corresponds to the contrapositive of the minor premise. This is the relationship between the opposite of the predicate and the opposite of the reason. If something is not the predicate, it is necessarily not the reason. So if something is not impermanent, in other words, if it is permanent, It is definitely not produced by causes. So is that right? If something is permanent, if it's not impermanent, it's not produced by causes. Okay? So the reason in the syllogism, you know, that third part, is the key to establish the three criteria. We must understand that the reason applies to the subject, is present in the predicate, and is not present in the opposite of the predicate. In simplified form, okay, C applies to A. The reason is a property of the subject. If it's C, it must be B. So if it's the reason, it must be the predicate. If it's not B, it can't be C. So if it's not the predicate, then it can't be the reason. Okay? So to gain an inferential cognizer, we must establish these three criteria in the syllogism. In general, the first criterion is something obvious. It can be established by means of a direct perceiver. So that's in general. Okay? We know that Joe is produced by causes. Yeah? We know he had a mom and dad. Okay? Or in the case of sound, we know that sound is produced by causes because we hear the sound after the bell is struck and we don't hear it otherwise. Then through reasoning, we try to establish something that is not obvious, that Joe is impermanent and momentary. Okay? So we know Joe is produced by causes. We know he has a mom and dad. Okay? But we don't know that Joe is momentary, that he changes moment by moment, or that even, you know, he can die. We don't know that. We don't, or we know it up here, but we don't really believe it, okay? If a syllogism is not formed correctly, it will not prove its thesis. That may mean that the thesis is wrong or that the person constructing the syllogism did not think well about the topic. Okay. So, consider Joe. Joe is impermanent because he exists. Yeah? So, Joe exists. That's okay. But if something exists, is it necessarily impermanent? No, it could also be permanent. Okay, so that's not a valid syllogism to prove that Joe is impermanent. Although the reason is established, Joe exists, the pervasion doesn't hold. If something exists, it is not necessarily impermanent. Permanent phenomena also exist. Okay. Usually, although they state three criteria, actually, if the second criteria, the pervasion, if that one works, you don't need to do the counter-pervasion. Yeah. In the syllogism, consider the person. He will die because he was born. Okay, so let's say talk about Joe again. Or talk about ourselves. I will die. Consider this person, me. I will die because I was born. So this person, or me, is the subject. Will die is the predicate. Because I was born is the reason. Okay? So what is the reason applying to the subject? What do you have to look at to establish that the reason applies to the subject?
Will I die? Because of, well,
yeah, I was born. There you establish that the reason born applied to the subject, me. Yes, it's true. I was born. Okay? Okay. Then do the privation. What's the privation going to be? If somebody is born, they necessarily will die. So that's just a general thing. You're not thinking about yourself. You know, it's just anybody. If anybody is born, they will die. Okay. Then you put those two together. Okay. Well, you also establish the counter-privation. If there is no death, it is because birth did not precede it. Yeah. Okay. But when the full force of this syllogism dawns in our mind, it becomes a powerful motivator for us to practice the Dharma in order to cease the causes of rebirth and cyclic existence, and thereby to cease death as well. Because from seeing this, you know, consider the person me, I will die because I was born. You establish, yes, I was born. You establish anybody who's born will die. Then the conclusion is, yes, I will die. Okay. Now, we intellectually understand this argument, right? That is a correct assumption. Is this argument at this moment motivating you to do something with your life? Maybe a little bit.
Probably more for the people in the front than in the back, though.
Yeah. So then you have to see. Speak for yourself, John. Okay. So, you know, so then we have to see, you know, how much is this moving us? Is this just an intellectual exercise? Or is it really making us go, oh, you know, I need to take this seriously. Okay. So that would be the difference between a correct assumption and you're going towards an inference. You don't have an actual inference yet, because if you had an actual inference, your whole life would change. Okay? But you haven't had that. So there's degrees of correct assumption, you know, between, yeah, it's a general thing to, you know, getting to the point where, yeah, it really moves you. Okay?
Do you think that you have to, like somebody at the monastic gathering told me this really good idea that she does in her practice, and I thought it really was excellent. And she'll do things like, these are the last mantras I'll ever say. This is the last time I'll ever say this prayer. You know, so just like brings death. Right
yeah.
There. But
yeah.
I was wondering if you think that you have to say these words to yourself for a syllogism, or you could just like, you know, convince yourself not even, it's rational, but it's not like the words are all there.
Yeah, I mean, eventually, the syllogism is the tool to get you to the understanding. For the understanding, you don't have to recite the syllogism.
What if the person never used syllogisms? They still could.
I think there's a subtle way of using a syllogism. Yeah. They may not say the words, but that same thought process is going on. Okay. Or maybe they use a different reason. You know, I am impermanent because, you know that everybody dies. Yeah, maybe they use that reason. Yeah, they have some reason. Yeah. Okay, otherwise we'd think we didn't die. We do not necessarily realize the thesis of a correct syllogism immediately after hearing it. To realize the three criteria of a correct syllogism, we must have a certain level of knowledge and be mentally receptive. we don't have that level of knowledge, if we aren't mentally receptive, we're blocking it. I don't want to hear about this impermanent stuff. Okay, then we're not going to understand the syllogism. Three preliminary reliable cognizers are needed in order to ascertain the second criteria, the pervasion. Okay, so let's look at the second criteria. Okay. In the syllogism, consider Joe. He is impermanent because he is produced by causes. Okay? So, you need a reliable cognizer ascertaining the reason, which is being produced by causes. Okay? So, being produced by causes is a reason that can establish that sound is impermanent. It is suitable to be used as a reason in this syllogism. Okay? The second thing is a reliable cognizer ascertaining that in the opposite of the predicate, the reason does not exist. Okay? So that means the opposite of the predicate is devoid of the reason. Among permanent phenomena, no products exist. So this is kind of like the counter-privation. Okay? Permanent phenomena are devoid of products. And then you need a reliable cognizer ascertaining that the predicate and its opposite are mutually exclusive. So permanent and impermanent are mutually exclusive. Okay. So it just basically means you have to understand the three parts of the syllogism themselves, what they mean before you can put them together to gain some kind of reason, you know, new knowledge. Sometimes ascertaining the three criteria requires a considerable amount of time and effort. A person may have to learn the meaning of terms or understand other syllogisms first. So if somebody gave you the syllogism, you know, Joe is impermanent because he's a product of causes, you know, or just because he's a product. Either one works. You may go, well, wait a minute, what's a product of causes mean? This is new terminology. I'm not familiar with it. Okay? So to understand the argument, you may have to learn what that new term means. Or if somebody's saying, you know, proposes as a subject something that you know nothing about. Yeah, then you're going to have to know what that subject is before you're going to be able to make sense out of the syllogism. Okay, so what we're saying here is that just because you have a syllogism that's correct, that the form of the syllogism is correct, it doesn't mean that we or anybody else is going to hear it and immediately go, got it. We may not understand, you know, it's if it says, the ikigugugugaga is impermanent because it's a product of causes. If you don't know what an ikigugugaga is, you know, okay, then you're not going to be able to prove that. If you don't understand what a product of causes is, you're not going to be able to prove that, okay? If you don't understand that permanent and impermanent are, you know, mutually exclusive, you won't be able to prove that. Okay. So you may have to learn the meaning of terms or understand other syllogisms first. Many texts contain debates in which a syllogism is presented, followed by other syllogisms that help us understand important points so that we will be able to comprehend the first syllogism. When we encounter difficult topics, we must persevere and continue to contemplate the material. As with most other subjects, it may be difficult at the beginning, but through familiarization, it becomes easier. So remember in the debate class we started a section, what was it, where we were having to, what was it? We were comparing two objects and we were saying it is a this and then we have to give a reason for it, and it is a that and we have to give a reason. So,
proofs.
Hmm?
Proofs.
Yeah, so what was the thing? Do you remember an example of it?
Well, you just said to give the definitions. It's a permanent, or it's permanent because it's a phenomenon that's not momentary.
Yeah, if we were trying to say, you know, the book is impermanent, then you have to explain the book is impermanent because, you know, it's momentary. Mm-hmm. You know, so those kinds of things that we went through, all of that, those are like the subsidiary reasons and kind of syllogisms that we have to understand in order to understand the main thing. Okay? So sometimes you just need to understand the words, sometimes, you know, why something is one object or another, or you may need other syllogisms. After presenting a syllogism to a person, three kinds of wisdom arise progressively over time. The wisdom arising from hearing or studying the Dharma, the wisdom arising from contemplating, thinking, and reflecting on it, and third, the wisdom arising from meditating. When we first learn about subtle impermanence by hearing a teaching or reading a Dharma book, our understanding is the wisdom arising from hearing. At best, this is a correct assumption that is a general idea about subtle impermanence. It is not the incontrovertible knowledge of an inferential reliable cognizer. While correct assumptions and factual inferential cognizers both focus on subtle impermanence, the depth and stability of their understandings differ. A correct assumption can easily become vague if we don't repeatedly familiarize ourselves with the topic. Also, if we are presented with the opposite view, a correct assumption may degenerate into doubt. Okay? So, you know, at the first time we hear a syllogism, we're learning something, yeah, don't think that, you know, you're going to get it and it's hard and fast and you're going to see it and that's really what it is. You know, it's the wisdom of hearing. So it's usually a correct assumption because we're just getting exposed to the reasoning and exposed to those things. By continuing to analyze, our correct assumption will become an inferential reliable cognizer that realizes subtle impermanence by means of a conceptual appearance. So this is the wisdom arising from contemplation. So you understood the syllogism, yeah, and it's a conceptual appearance of the impermanence of Joe that's appearing to your mind, okay? This inferential understanding will not degenerate unless we allow the intensity of this cognition to deteriorate by ceasing to contemplate the topic. So once you understand something, you have to keep thinking about it. Otherwise, your understanding, even if it's an inference, it can fade away. The deterioration of inferential reliable cognizers occurs because the seeds of wrong views haven't been eliminated completely from our mental continuums, and our familiarity with the correct view is not strong. For this reason, we must make effort to maintain the correct understandings we gain through repeatedly bringing them to mind. Okay, so that's why when we do Lam Rim meditation, yeah, it isn't that you just do it once and then maybe you get some strong feeling and okay, got that, let's go on to the next thing. If you have that attitude, then your initial feeling that you got that really moved you is going to fade away. Yeah. So we have to, that's why we keep doing these meditations over and over and over again, because, you know, at first, just to sometimes it takes work just to get a correct assumption. And then having gotten that, we need a lot of familiarity, you know, to move it into an inference. It's not just quick. It takes that persistent repetition. Why? Because as it says, we have so many seeds of wrong views in our mind, and they're quite strong, and they come to the surface and then overpower the correct understanding. To deepen our understanding, we continue to cultivate concentration and analytical wisdom so that we can attain the union of serenity and insight on subtle impermanence. This is the wisdom arising from meditation. Initially, this wisdom is conceptual because the veil of the conceptual appearance of impermanence is present. But with continuous meditation over time, that veil becomes thinner and thinner and will eventually disappear, and we will realize subtle impermanence directly and non-conceptually. This yogic direct perceiver of subtle impermanence is also the wisdom arising from meditation. Okay, maybe we'll stop here.